It's been a long day, but the night will go on for even longer. It's 2 minutes to midnight, and the next one is on judicial politics. Unfortunately, I'm not Bruce Dickinson, and this is not an Iron Maiden show. The good thing is there are not only rednecks called Max or Per in the audience, but 200 of the best and most educated political science students in the world. And this lecture series is still called International Relations and European Integration. A warm welcome from my side. Today, we have a three-part setup where we talk a little bit about some specific cases of judicial politics in the European Union, and then I will introduce you to the European Court of Justice. And in the end, we talk a little bit about infringement proceedings and especially political science research on that. So, for the first and the second part, you read the textbook chapter by Hicks and Hoyland. And for the last part, you partly read the Hoge Rau edited volume chapter on the commission, where it's about at least 2 pages about the infringement proceedings. Before we start, really, after my chocolate excursion last time, I thought it would make a lot of sense to focus on the basics. And for today, for tonight, I bought this one. It's called Cassis de Dijon. I don't know if you already read it in, for example, the Hicks and Hoyland textbook. I never would have thought that you get it here, but actually, I bought it in the Paradies Edeka, and you can now witness a world premiere. I never drank it actually 5 minutes ago. I Googled it now, how to drink it, and you should mix it with champagne or something, then it would be a Key Royale. But for the show here, I try to have a shot of this thing. We will come to the Cassis de Dijon, to the Cassis later on. I simply try it today. So we talk about the Cassis, for example. Seems to be. Okay. I will come to that in a minute. We talked for the last two sessions about the European institutions. So the European Council and the Commission, the executive politics, and then the European Parliament and the Council, so the legislative side. And today we finish our institutional block with the European Court of Justice mainly, but also the Commission then once again, which brings us full circle back to the executive politics. Okay, I think you understood the setup more graphically. First, we had the executive consisting of this, then we talked about the legislative process, and today we focus mainly on the European Court of Justice in relationship to the national governments and the citizens, but also to the European Commission. But it was too long for this gray cloud to also include the European Commission. So we mainly really focus on the European Court of Justice today. Okay, I will start with some cases to talk about the relevance of this whole session today. As I already mentioned, I'm neither an expert on the European Court of Justice, nor do I think it's so relevant for political science. It's politically or legal, of course, relevant for the European Union, but you will hardly find any good political science scholarship on the European Court of Justice or on this judicial politics. It's mainly then really the focus of the lawyers. So we also today, as we would be lawyers, we start with some cases to talk about the general meaning for European integration of the European Court of Justice. And I want to start with the first case from 1962, which is called Van Genderlos versus the Netherlands administration. What happened there? So we remember already with the Treaty of Rome, Treaty on the European Coal and Steel community, already there a European Court of Justice was established, okay? And so this court already started its ruling in the 60s. In the 60s, Van Gendt en Lens, which was a transportation company, imported something from West Germany, but the authorities charged them a tariff on the import. And already then, this company thought this was a clear violation of the Article 12 of the Treaty of Rome, which basically was for a free economic area on this certain trade issue. And then the question arose, how should we handle this? So because the Article 12 of the Treaty of Rome said member states shall refrain from introducing between themselves any new customs duties or imports and export on any charges having equivalent effect and from increasing those which they already apply in their trade with each other. Okay, sounds a little bit like the Brexit agreement. So, and the question then for the court was whether Article 12 of the EEC treaty has direct application within the territory of a member state. In other words, whether nationals of such a state can, on the basis of the article in question, lay claim to individual rights which the court must protect. And then it's the more technical thing about really these taxes. So can an individual company go to the European Court of Justice and have an objection there is the question. And then the court ruled in 62. In addition, the task assigned to the Court of Justice under Article 177, it's again the EEC, the object of which is to secure uniform interpretation of the treaty by national courts and tribunals, confirms that the states have acknowledged that community law has an authority which can be invoked by their nationals before those courts and tribunals. So, the meaning of this sentence is European law has a direct effect as law of land and citizens. So we are moving away already in the 60s. We are moving away from this idea of an international organization that it's a treaty between member states and only member states can complain. This is how, for example, the WTO works until today, okay? And we're moving into the direction of something like a federal unit with a higher court. So in the second subpart, it says, independently of the legislation of member states, community law therefore not only imposes obligations on individuals, but is also intended to confer upon them rights which become part of their legal heritage, okay? Direct effect first, aha moment, okay. Already in 62, European law has a direct effect on the citizens of the member states of the European community. First case, Van Gendt en Lens versus this port administration. Second case, Mr. Costa versus Enel. What happened 2 years later, 64? An Italian citizen everywhere, he's called Mr. Costa. I guess he's called Flaminio Costa, but it's Mr. Costa in all the literature, okay? Mr. Costa owned shares of an electricity company in Italy, which was called Edison Volta, and opposed the nationalization of the electricity sector in Italy. The Italian government planned to nationalize the electricity sector. It was partly privatized then in the 60s there. Mr. Costa not only owned shares of this partly private electricity company, he then, to make it a case, refused to pay his electricity bill to this new company. So he asked two lower courts in Milan to ascertain that the real creditor of his electricity bill, which was 1,925 lira, it seems not the biggest amount in the world, was the nationalized company, Edison Volta, or the newly established then state-owned company Enel. This is why it's called Mr. Costa versus Enel. So it's basically, again, the question, is this allowed under the Treaty of Rome, the European Economic Community, where there was no such thing like nationalization of companies? Treaty of Rome versus the nationalization of electricity sectors or the electricity sector. And then the ruling of the court in 64 in this case was, by contrast with ordinary international treaties, the EEC treaty has created its own legal system, which on the entry into force of the treaty became an integral part of the legal system of member states and which their courts are bound to apply, which means already in 64 then, the European Court of Justice ruled there's a supremacy of European law over national law, okay? And then it goes on, by creating a community of unlimited duration, having its own institution, its own personality, its legal capacity and capacity of representation on the international panel, and more particularly real powers stemming from a limitation of sovereignty or a transfer of powers from the states to the community, the member states have limited their sovereign rights, albeit within limited fields, and have thus created a body of law which binds both their nationals and themselves. A clear indication of the supremacy of European law, and also a clear indication of what we, how we started in the beginning. Okay, already in 64, the court clearly stated, you transferred sovereignty to a supranational level, please live with the consequences, okay? You're not sovereign, totally sovereign anymore. There is something like European law now, and your national law has to adapt to it, okay? This is the second dimension. So direct applicability and supremacy of European Union law. Now comes the third case, which I use as a starter. And there we come to the Cassis here. It's the Rewe Zentrale versus the Bundesmonopolverwaltung für Brandwein in 1979. And it boils down to das Brandweinmonopolgesetz from 1922, so the spirit monopoly law or something like this. It's not spirit, but I have no idea. And what was the case actually, okay? The Rewe Zentrale wanted to buy, import a Cassis de Dijon from France. Problem was, this Brandwein Monopolgesetz states that liquor has to have a certain amount of alcohol. It's only liquor if it's, and then it you can sell and buy it in a given quantums. It's only liquor when it has more than 25% of alcohol. And I don't know if you see it, the Cassis de Dijon only has 16%, which meant it does not fall under the Brandweinmonopolschutzgesetz, or it violates the Brandweinmonopol, okay? This is why the Bundesmonopolverwaltung forbid the Rewe Zentrale to sell the Cassis de Dijon as Brandwein, as Schnaps, basically, okay? And typically German, they had a great argument why the Brandwein Monopolgesetz is actually doing. So there is a minimum, the government of the Federal Republic of Germany states that the minimal alcohol content of alcoholic beverages leads to, on the one hand, the protection of public health, and on the other hand, to the protection of the consumer against unfair commercial practices, because it's harder to buy. I guess this is the argument. This is why Hartstoff basically is better for the public health than lower so beverages with lower amount of alcohol. This is why they want actually not allowed to sell it in Germany. But then third ruling, the Cassis de Dijon ruling, ruled that, so number 14, it's clear from the foregoing that the requirements relating to the minimum alcohol content of alcoholic beverages do not serve a purpose which is in the general interest as such as to take precedence over the requirements of the free movement of goods, which constitutes one of the fundamental rules of the community. It therefore appears that the unilateral requirement imposed by the rules of a member state of a minimum alcohol content for the purpose of the sale of alcoholic beverages constitute an obstacle to trade, which is incompatible with the provision of Article 30 of the treaty, which again means, okay, your national law cannot prohibit the general free movements of goods. Opposed to the previous ruling, this was not really related to a very specific clause in the treaties, but it was more related to the general spirit of the European community, free movement of goods. And from that point on, the European Court of Justice was seen as a motor of economic integration. So everything that hindered economic integration, that somehow hindered the single market, could then be or was objected by the European Court of Justice if someone went to the court and claimed something was wrong here. So this is maybe the third step here. The European Court of Justice really as a motor of economic integration, but also the European Court of Justice as a player in the 70s and 80s that already was perceived as having unintended consequences of integration. Okay, no one thought that the Court of Justice would become so strong that the court gave individual rulings on given topics that the nation states actually want to maybe keep on a national level. So there was this this path dependency of unintended consequences and of spillovers that were then handled by the European Court of Justice here. This is our third case to consider. So everything pointed towards more integration by the European Court of Justice. On the other hand, more recent example from 2019, we see here now the German court and Andreas Voskuhle in particular here as one of the federal justice, so it's a constitutional court, and the Constitutional Court of Germany then, here a German court lays down law in defiance of the European Union. What happened? There was last year a landmark ruling on the legality of the European Central Bank's bond buying program. So the Central Bank buyed bonds from banks and countries, and it did so with the backup of the European Court of Justice, which already ruled in 2018 that this was a legal practice because there was already a claim, okay? Dismissing this decision to allow the bond purchases, the German court ordered the ECB to provide Germany with adequate justifications for the program within the next three months. Should it fail to do so, the Bundesbank, German Central Bank obviously, would no longer be permitted to participate in the program. The decision sets the stage for a showdown between the ECB, which as an independent European Union institution does not have to take orders from the German court, and the government of Berlin. The ECB said in a statement it took note of the German ruling and remains fully committed to its mandate. Okay, this is the economic side, but now we come more to the general politics critics of the German court's move worry that that by refusing to accept the Court of Justice position, it effectively undermined the court's legitimacy, opening the door for other countries to ignore rulings when they disagree with them. So here in 2019, actually the German Constitutional Court criticized or somehow negated our first principle, our second principle, the supremacy of EU law, because it ruled after the European Court of Justice already had a ruling that it's allowed what the ECB was doing. Afterwards, they ruled that for Germany, it's not allowed. And here we see then the political side, and we also see the struggles and the power dimension. All these things seem still to be ongoing or seems to be somehow contested. And once someone start to contest them, like here Voskuhle in particularly, then others might follow, because at a time when the European Union is in clinch with both Hungary and Poland over steps governments in those countries have taken to roll back the rule of law and democracy, the question is far from academic. Ours is academic, but okay, we are in a delicate time frame, especially in Poland, where politicians are challenging the CGEU. They will seize this example and say, we are not the only ones. So the real supremacy of European Union legislation still can be contested by individual rulings of the court, of national courts, which simply gives us a flavor of this underlying power struggle that still is going on. Do we really stick to the norm of European Union law supremacy, or is the union somehow now at the verge of falling into its parts because this 50-year-old principle of EU law supremacy somehow is negated now or is criticized by national institutions? So this is my starting point for today's sessions. These four rulings that first of all hinted towards more integration, and especially the idea of a supranational, also legal entity on the European level. And nowadays, again, the tendency for disintegration also by the legal or judicial dimension of the European Union. Let's come to the European Court of Justice. Compared to the legislative branch and the executive, where we always saw there are mainly two institutions in a bicameral system sharing some kind of power. In judicial politics, it's really mainly one institution, the European Court of Justice. We will come to the fact that the Commission somehow takes part in the infringement proceedings in the end. But when we talk about judicial politics, okay, it's the Court of Justice most of the time. What is the European Court of Justice doing? It has three tasks. Reviewing the legality of acts that the European Union institutions produce, establishing infringements. So if something is not really good applied in member states, there's this infringement proceeding. I will talk about this later on. And I guess it's her main part nowadays is giving preliminary rulings, which basically means a national court asks the European Court of Justice for its opinion on a given topic. Okay, and then there are these preliminary rulings if something is in compliance with EU law or not. Basically, there are two different courts who do these different tasks. There's the Court of Justice. These are 27 judges, one judge per member state, and 11 advocates general that somehow coordinate the different activities and help these judges. Six of them are always from the six most powerful member states, and five are rotating candidates. And then there's the general court, who has now two judges per member state since 2019, and they are both located in Luxembourg. Let's look at the first question, how to become a judge at the European Court of Justice. As I said, and the same holds for the General Chamber, so there's no big difference, okay, how this whole system works. The Court of Justice consists of 27 judges, so every member state is allowed to send one, and these judges hold an office for a renewable term of 6 years. They are chosen from legal experts whose independence is beyond doubt, quote here, and who possess the qualification required for appointment to the highest judicial offices in their respective countries, or who are of recognized competence. The Court of Justice is, or this nomination procedure, in contrast to the Commission nomination procedure, is really apolitical and not really contested, which means in practice, each member state nominates a judge and then all the others ratify this given judge. I haven't found a case where there's contestation over the judges as compared to these problems with some commissioners. In Germany, for example, the government and the Bundestag, they decide together on a candidate and then send it to Brussels. The German judge of the Court of Justice is Thomas von Danwitz. And you see, for example, here, he's beyond doubt the qualifications, but he hasn't held the highest judicial offices, but rather is of recognized competence because he's basically a law professor, if I get his vita here right. So you must not have to come from the National General Court or something like this. Here we have a law professor, so an academic more or less. They actually produce very nice overviews at the European Court of Justice. When you look at the facts, they have around 400 million to spend as budget. With this budget, they have around 2,000 officials, and also their gender balance is already quite nice. When we look on what they are doing to the Court of Justice in the year 2019, there were 966 cases in that time period. 641 were about these preliminary rulings that I said that national governments or courts come to the European Court of Justice and wanted to have a preliminary ruling how to interpret the validity of an act adopted by the European Union. Direct actions, then the 41s are the infringement, mainly the infringement procedures to which we will come in a minute. When we look at this amount over time, you see this new cases, completed cases and cases pending. There seems to be a small increase, but over the years, it rather stays stable. When I look from 600 new cases to 2014 to 800 new cases, for example, in 2018. The General Court, so the other chamber, which has these two judges per member states, has basically the same amount of cases, but they have these direct actions, which means these are proceedings by natural or legal persons, so everyone can do this, and by member states against acts of the institutions, bodies, offices, or agencies of the European Union, and indirect actions seeking compensation for damages caused by the institutions and their staff. So you really complain about European Union law or actions of the European institutions, a large part of the litigation before it is economic in nature, okay? This is the economic side of the integration process. So of these 939 cases, there are 850 of these direct actions. Okay, it's about intellectual, industrial properties, state aid competition, and so on. So these are the two chambers. Actually, they do not When I said 27 plus 27, so 54 judges, they do not act together, but they have specific subtopics, and 3 to 5 judges then always constituent one unit to give these rulings. The general court has more cases pending, but and has slightly more cases, but has basically also not a high rise of cases over the last years, but stayed also stayed constant in the amount between 800 and 1,000 cases. These were the basic facts. What is now the judicial politics side? Until now, it was only judicial, I don't know, facts or however you want to call it. But politics basically means there are power interests, okay? This is why we are political scientists. We are interested in power. We are interested in regulations for wider citizenships. And this is why the setup then presented in the Hicks and Hoyland book is the following. So every piece of law and international treaties also, or the European treaties, is an incomplete contract, because you never know what will happen in a concrete case, okay? Which means the actors that are enforced these laws can use their discretion to shape policy outcomes. So you make a very general rule, like free trade or no restrictions for trade between countries. And then the friction starts. You have a specific national rule on liquor content. And then the question is what happens, which means it gives again power, discretion to shape some policies, power also to the courts. And again, we are here in the principal agent framework. Judges are no neutral actors. So on the one hand, this means already in making the laws, so in the legislative process, there might be strategic interactions between legislators and judges in policy makings. Okay, this is this one dimension. Maybe legislators already anticipate what the judges might do. This is again this anticipation logic, and on the other hand, there could be strategic choices of the executives and legislators in the selection of judges. As I already said, actually in the European Union, I don't think this is the case. Okay, there is no big strategic choice in terms of ideology or party politics in this area. But generally, we of course can assume that this logic could prevail if it gets politicized in the future or something like this. What is the legal basis? As I said, this is the only politics side, the political science side, but in my opinion, there is not much in there, okay? So let's care a little bit more. You had it in the Hicks and Hoyland book, again, a one-dimensional space, and the Court of Justice is also a player in there. You can see the world every time like this, but this time I don't think it makes much sense, okay? What is the legal basis of the European Court of Justice? Maybe this is a little bit more interesting to us. Of course, it's the primary law and the secondary law. We had this now every session here. So the treaties and every kind of piece of legislation that emerged out of the legislative process. But additionally, it's also the general principles of law. And this might be interesting to mention. So in the Treaty of the European Union, Article 19 states, the Court of Justice of the European Union shall include the Court of Justice, General Court, and specialized courts. It shall ensure that in the interpretation and application of the treaties, the law is observed. So the general law is observed. And what are the interpretation and applications of the treaties? So there are four principles, and the most important one is the second one. There's the principle of administrative and legislative legality. So look at the nation state's legality. There are the economic freedoms, okay? And already in the four cases, I guess at least in the three starting cases, two of them, and especially the Cassis de Dijon case, it was about the economic freedoms. And this is, of course, somehow legalized, but it's more the general principle of the treaties or of the European Economic Project more in general. So there you have some kind of discretion to interpret the law. This is the important part, I guess. So you should interpret all kind of laws in terms of the economic freedoms that are the basis of the primary law or the spirit. And then we have the fundamental human rights and the political rights. These become now more important since we talk about autocratic backsliding in Poland and Hungary, for example, where the Court of Justice in the last 2 years, the individual judges played an important role in pointing towards a non-compliance with political rights and fundamental human rights in changing institutions, democratic institutions in the member states. So the European Court of Justice became there an important player, not so much on a legal side, but more on a public intellectual side and an agenda setting side to point towards the autocratic tendencies that happened in the past years in given countries. This is the legal basis, okay? And then we ask ourselves about the effects. There you read this thing about the constitutionalization of the European Union. And of course, it is like this, that after, I don't know, the 1980s, the European Court, but also all European institutions somehow developed an understanding of their own more or less as a federation and as a real supranational entity. And so they started with this idea of a constitution of Europe, okay? And more particularly, it was first mentioned in 1968, based on these two principles that we already heard, okay? So European law has a direct effect on land and citizens. So it's more comparable to national law than to international law. Once again, think about the WTO. Only nation states can complain there. Okay. And then nation states also has to pay the bills, basically. In the WTO, we in the litigation body of the WTO, we speak about the strongest court in international organizations that we have besides the European Court of Justice. Okay. So we can see the constitutionalization is based on this direct effect and on the supremacy of European Union law. We already had this, that national legislative majorities are permanently bound to the European Union law that maybe other majorities once decided, okay? And this somehow, both of these principles led towards this idea of the constitutionalization of the European Union that most famously Weyler then formulated as transformation from an international organization to a quasi-federal polity. And then once again, the idea that the European Court of Justice plays a central role in the economic and political integration of the European Union, okay? There he, she, it has its best moments in the 80s and in the 90s, I guess. I want to briefly link this, now that we know about this institution, I want to link it to our third integration theory. Maybe now you understand better how this supranationalism, especially of Stone Sweden and Sandholz, worked, or there, this was exactly their premises, okay? The constitutionalization of the European Union based on what the European Court of Justice was ruling. So the power of the European Court of Justice that it developed over the years and that was maybe not foreseeable and somehow contradicted the intergovernmental reading of Moravcik, nation states alone decide what's happening in Europe. So it was this thing, it's about legal integration, not political integration, focus mainly on secondary law and court rulings, so court interpretations also of primary law that often then also ended in secondary law. and focus on supranational, subnational, and supranational actors, especially as you can see now or understand better, it was not about a transfer of loyalties or something like this, but about functional spillovers. Okay, we have the single market, but we want to sell liquor, something like this. Okay, this is a problem. We need more regulations. Okay, so there, with this whole idea that the court really is the motor of integration, there this theory of supranationalism is heavily linked. Let's turn finally maybe to the most interesting part from the view of a young political scientist, and I mean you, not me, the European Court of Justice interactions with the member state, which boils down to the infringement proceedings. Okay, what is the infringement proceeding? I labeled it principal problem. Okay, previously we had principal agent problems, but with these infringement proceedings, it's not so clear who's the principal and who is the agent, because the European Court of Justice should control what the nation states are doing in transposing directives to national law. And if they don't do this, there is an infringement proceeding, okay? Mm. So, and it starts like this, or there are different steps how this proceeding works, okay? Actually, four or five steps. If a member state concerned fails to communicate measures that fully transpose the provision of directives or doesn't rectify the suspected violation of EU law, the Commission may launch a formal infringement procedure. So, okay, we are on the level of judicial policies, but now the Commission kicks in again, okay? It's not primarily the Court of Justice, but we had this two sessions ago, when it's about looking for a concrete implementation, the Commission starts, okay? So and we are mainly talking about directives, not regulations. You know, directive means you have a certain degree of freedom, how you want to reach the goals. So, but if the Commission thinks something is wrong here, then it can start an infringement procedure. How does this work? First step, okay? The Commission sends a letter of formal notice requesting further information on the country concerned, which must send a detailed reply within a specific period, usually 2 months. So something is going wrong with one policy. I don't know. There's a general law or general directive on how to handle plastic bottles or something like this. And then you see in one member state, the plastic bottles are swimming in the lakes or something like this. And then maybe the Commission asks, hey, we had this environmental regulation directive on plastic bottles. What's happening actually? And then the country has to reply and give concrete measures. Okay, we collected 5 billion of these bottles. So I think we are okay with law and or not. Second step, if the Commission concludes that the country is failing to fulfill its obligations under European Union law, it may send a reasoned opinion, which is a formal request to comply, please, with a European Union law. It requests that the country inform the Commission of the measures taken within a specified period, usually 2 months. Okay, there you do not only have to report, but you also have to report what you did to increase your policy output or to make the situation better, okay? And if step three, if this still doesn't work, if the country still doesn't comply, the Commission may decide to refer the matter to the Court of Justice. Now the Court of Justice comes in. Most cases, but footnote, most cases are settled before being referred to the court. So these infringement proceedings are most of the time handled in stage one or stage two. Actually, like with the WTO, once you start it, the member states then really try to comply as fast as possible. But there are instances where member states don't comply, and this is why it's political science relevant, because of course we want to know, do they comply? do they not comply because it's a political will? They really decide not to comply, or because they have no capacity or whatever. Okay, this is our, these are our questions. So it may, if they still don't comply, the member states goes to the Court of Justice. And if a country still fails to communicate measures that implement the provision of a directive in time, the Commission may ask the court to impose penalties. You have to pay. Get less of the budget. If the court then finds that a country has breached EU law, the national authorities must take action to comply with the court judgment. Okay, so these are the stages of escalation, basically. And somehow this is the mechanism how the European Union tries to solve non-compliance, okay? Because the goal, of course, is everyone complies with the rules. Does it work? It works quite good. But of course, there are many cases of non-compliance. Some very present examples. So I simply copied and pasted this morning from the website. The good thing with the infringement proceedings is, and the good thing with the European Commission in general, they collect a lot of data and information, and it's freely available. So first step letter of formal notice, here is an example. There seems to be a problem with the free movement of goods and freedom of establishment. Commission asks Slovakia to remove restrictions on food retailers and closes against Romania. Okay, something with the free market. We heard this already. So simply formal letter of notice. Please give us information. There seems to be a problem. Then one step further down the escalation road, reasoned opinions, free movement of goods. Commission urges Germany to remove restrictions on import of coffee. The Commission decided today to send a reasoned opinion to Germany regarding restriction on imports of coffee under the German coffee tax law. We have, of course, a law for everything. Huh? There's Kaffeesteuergesetz. Retailers established in another member state selling coffee to Germany must appoint a fiscal representative located in Germany. The representatives needs to be approved by the German customs authority, blah, blah, blah. This seems to somehow restrict imports on coffee. And also, actually, it was a random choice, but I can tell you, for example, the coffee law in Germany is rather complex. Why do I know this? Because one day I got for a birthday a coffee seminar here down in this strange Dolce Vita coffee shop where I learned how to make espresso. And there I learned, for example, that there exists a Kaffeemahlsteuer in Germany. For every kilo coffee you mal, whatever that is, you have to pay €3. And it goes into the direction that the coffee market seems to be heavily regulated. And if you want to import something, you have to stick to the German authorities. This now, the Commission thinks that this is not okay. Let's look what's happening. Maybe the coffee becomes cheaper because we don't have to pay Kaffeemahlsteuer anymore. But still, Germany can now say how which measures they apply or how they reform their coffee tax law and this specific problem here to solve the problem, okay? And a third part here, referral to the Court of Justice. Trademarks Commission decided to refer Romania to the Court of Justice for not transposing the trademark directive. No idea what the trademark directive is, but there seems to be a concrete political will of Romania not to transpose it. And then this is the obvious question, what to do? Now European Court of Justice and the Court of Justice rules, and somehow maybe there will be a fiscal penalty or something if they don't transpose this directive in a proper fashion. You see most of the time directives, and this is how the European simply works. As I said, the European Union and the Commission is very good in collecting data. You simply can download the number of infringement proceedings over the year. And you can see that there was with enlargement, there was an increase in these proceedings up to 1,330 a year, and then it went down, which also is somehow an effect. This pilot 15 and pilot 25 means the Commission tried new management concepts in communicating with the member states if there was is a problem before they officially start an infringement proceeding. But nowadays, still in December 19, we are at around 800 infringement proceedings a year. When we look only for Germany, we can see we are always above the average of infringement proceedings of a given country. Our highlight was in 2005 with 100, and in 2019 we still had 47 of these proceedings. When we look for 2019 on cross-country variation, we can see Spain is the one not complying, whereas the smaller countries here, Latvia, Estland, Lithuania, Finland, and Luxembourg, they seem to comply the best. Actually, red means increase from 2018-2019. And you see, for example, in Czech and Belgium, there is a decrease. Okay. And when you look at the duration measured in months, these, on average, these proceedings can take quite long. On average, the UK, okay, of course, they simply delayed in the last years. For them, it took the longest, whereas again, the smaller or Central and Eastern European countries seem to be faster than in giving in towards complying to national to European law. If I present you numbers and bars, this normally means there is variation and there is political science. And of course, it is like this. I want to end with a classic study of the Berlin team. And I think this is very nice. Again, you see, okay, there is the data. There is the phenomena. Non-compliance or infringement procedures. And of course, we as political scientists want to know why, okay? We want to know the reason. And I guess the first real quantitative analytical study was by Bertel and colleagues, especially I want to mention my good old friend Tobias Hoffmann, who studied here in Konstanz too. And it's a nice article in CPS from 2010. Actually, Bertel started simply to collect all the data on the infringement proceedings. And they looked at 6,300 violations in European Union law and simply tried to give us reason why states don't comply. And I think this is very nicely written. If you take the first paragraph of this article, so not in the introduction, not the abstract, there it boils down really to our IR theories from the beginning, okay? One of the major questions in the research on international institutions has been why governments seeking to promote their own interests ever comply with the rules of international regimes when they view these rules as in conflict with their myopic self-interest. This is the biggest question. So why do states stick to international rules when they either do not want to have them or when they could free ride? And then we have the four schools here in the first paragraph. Isn't it nice? Also, realists argue that states simply do not comply. Okay, realism wrong, we see they comply. Rational institutionalists point to the role of international regimes and organizations whose monitoring, sanctioning, and education mechanisms increase the costs of non-compliance. This is the institutionalist logic, okay? Institutions make it predictable, but also more costly not to comply. By contrast to these enforcement theories, the management approach assumes that non-compliance is involuntarily and results from a lack of resources. Toby Hoffmann is, of course, from the Department of Politics and Public Administration. He has also a knowledge about the management process. And finally, Tanja Bertel kicks in with social constructivist approaches that stress legitimacy, socialization, and norms of internationalization, meaning more socialization, less infringement proceedings because you want to comply. Okay, what's happening? We see there is the variation. And what they simply did is took all the infringement proceedings of a given period, I guess from 68 to 2000 or something like this, and took the reasoned opinions. So only step two, okay, and looked, tried to find indicator for the different theories. So for the realists, for example, it was power measured as GDP, simply size of the economy, and SSE, which is the Shapley-Shubik index. So the how much power you have in European Union in the council decision-making process. Then there are the capacity arguments, GDP capacity per capita, maybe not the best argument, but efficiency, which is an index of bureaucratic efficiency and professionalism of the public service. So how good is your public administration? The better you think, the better you comply also with rules. And then this legitimacy question, basically the constructivist approach, the rule of law in a country, and the European Union support measured by public opinion data. And what can we see? More power, more non-compliance. Okay, so powerful states really play their power card and do not comply, or do longer not comply with directives they do not want to have. But also we see this efficiency, the capacity argument. The more efficient your administration, the less likely non-compliance gets. So less cases of non-compliance. I think this is a real nice, basic, intuitive, empirical study that answers some of the bigger questions of IR. And to make it even better, they really looked, then they have only 15 countries, okay, looked into the variation between the countries and found two different trends. When compliance improves, we have the efficiency here on the x-axis, on the y-axis power measured by the Shapley-Shubik. And you saw for different countries, there are different things. So whereas really the Shapley-Shubik index, so the less powerful countries are, the more they comply. It seems to hold for almost all countries. But there is also this interaction effect with efficiency. So more efficiency also leads to the best compliers, Denmark, but also it can explain why the powerful country like the UK complies more than Italy, for example, which is less efficient in its administration than the UK, but has the same more or less power in terms of the Shapley-Shubik index. I think this is a nice finding, and that should lead you into the night, or maybe also the day. I don't know when you watch this thing. I wanted to give you some examples what lawyers, but also theorists of European integration meant with the constitutionalization of the European Union. And I wanted to show you some examples how concrete court rulings led to more integration. I especially, of course, wanted to point to the dimension of the direct effect and the supremacy of European Union law. But I also wanted to point to this dimension that still these power struggles between the institutions continue. Then in the second part, I introduced to the European Court of Justice, it was basically descriptive facts, okay? And in the third part, I looked more specifically into the infringement procedures, tried to link it a little bit more to the political science or IR theory. So why do states comply and why don't they comply? And there we also saw that in terms of infringements, maybe the European Union works better than normal international organizations, but it works with the same logic. So these questions, why do states comply at all, also still can be used for analyzing the European Union. that was it almost for today. Next time we speak about regulation and responsiveness, this will be a very interesting session. If you watch this on Monday or on Tuesday, we, Gerald and I, totally forgot to mention or to point to the fact it would be nice if you do this evaluation. I already have written you a mail now that you see this video, but also on a personal note, it's my first lecture here in Konstanz, and I have no idea how this worked out until now. It would be very nice to get a small feedback. So if you have 5 minutes left on your day, I would be thankful if you simply do this evaluation of this. Of this lecture. I think it will be helpful and for me. I of course hope that I will never again will do this online thing, but will next time will interact you within an auditorium or a seminar room, but still this feedback I would appreciate if you do this for us. So much for today. Thanks very much.